Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming possibility of a government shutdown on Friday and analyze who has leverage at the moment and which party will be blamed if Washington grinds to a halt. Democratic strategist Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, joins us. We'll discuss what strategies the Senate Democrats might employ in the face of the outrageous lies from Trump and Senators Cotton and Perdue, who trashed the truth-teller Senator Durbin. We'll assess whether the Democrats can draw a line and say we are not talking to the White House or the Republicans until they stop lying, because what is the point of negotiating with liars? And since the Democratic base will not sacrifice dreamers for wasting money on Trump's wall, which he will not budge on, we will look into whether, with the Democrats poised to take back the House and possibly the Senate in November, using DACA as the issue upon which to shut down the government will hurt Democrats in Missouri, Indiana, West Virginia, and other red states. Then we'll examine further the showdown over DACA versus the wall and who gets blamed for shutting down the government, and speak with Robert Shapiro, a professor and the former chair of the Department of Political Science at Columbia University and author of Politicians Don't Pander, Political Manipulation and the Loss of Democratic Responsiveness. He joins us to discuss the Democrats' dilemma and the Republican lying, with the Washington Post counting over 2,000 lies Trump has told in his first year in office, and the shameless lies Senators Cotton and Perdue are engaged in covering up for Trump. Then finally, with Trump proclaiming today, January the 16th, Religious Freedom Day, we will discuss the historical hypocrisy of celebrating the religious rights idea of religious freedom and the absurdity of their claim that the founders wanted a Christian nation, when in fact Jefferson, Madison, and other founders championed religious tolerance because they had witnessed the public beatings of Baptist preachers and still carried the memory of women branded as witches being burned at the stake. Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates, joins us to discuss how the theocratic bent of the religious right and their intolerance towards women's rights and the LGBT community makes a mockery of religious freedom. And joining us now is Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Engel.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Well, thanks, Matt. And I was going to give you the task of answering or coming up with a strategy to get out of this exquisite dilemma that seems to be looming here with the possible government shutdown on Friday. The question is, of course, who's going to be blamed for it if it happens? I don't see Donald Trump ever giving up on DACA and on the wall, simply because if he makes a deal, he'll rile up his base and they won't show up in 2018. And on the Democratic side, it would seem to me that if you make the issue of shutting down the government entirely about illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants, which is a better term, obviously, then you end up with losing House seats or the possibility of picking up the House, because Missouri, West Virginia, Indiana, and these other red states with Democratic House and Senate members are vulnerable. So what would your strategy be going forward, since we've only got a couple of days here?
Well, I think that Democrats are in a stronger position than they have been in a very, very long time. And my advice is to stay steady, don't blink, that the public, to a greater degree than I can remember in my political lifetime, understand who holds the levers of power in Washington. They understand that Republicans control the Congress and control the White House. And if they wanted to fund the government, they could do so without a single Democratic vote, that it's disunity within their own party that's the problem. And then on top of that, they've thrown in the chaos of Trump, who has made it very clear that he doesn't understand the substance of the argument. and that he's not really capable of demonstrating the leadership. He's just going to point fingers and lay blame, and it's just as likely that when it's all over with, he'll point his finger at the Republicans in Congress and lay blame at them, and if he does, he'll be right.
But could the Democrats make the issue not just over immigration, but also over the fact that Senator Durbin is essentially being called a liar by both Trump and Senators Cotton and Perdue, when it's pretty clear the entire world believes what Senator Durbin said? It was buttressed by Senator Graham, who talked to Senator Scott about it, and also Senator Flake was also learned about it as well. I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever. Certainly in my mind, and most of the world, as I say, believes that Trump said what he said. So my sense would be, if I was a Democrat in the Senate and my colleague was being insulted in this way, I would want to say to both Trump and the Republicans, what's the point of talking to you guys? You just lie. So you can't negotiate with liars.
I think that's exactly what is playing out, Ian. And again, because it is so apparent that Senator Durbin and Senator Graham are telling the truth, and that Senators Cotton and Perdue and other administrative officials are lying, that the media is really, on its own, doing a very good job of demonstrating who's lying and who's not. And there is, at the end of the day, a real understanding that this is exactly what the public hates about politicians, when they parse words in order to perpetuate a lie. And that's what Cotton and Perdue are doing. I think it further strengthens Democrats' hands, and I think it goes to a bigger thing. It goes beyond the funding, and it goes beyond who's lying, and it goes to the inability of Republicans, even while they're controlling the White House and they're controlling Congress, to figure out and solve a problem. And I think the public knows that they've made a mess of this. There's been a lot of talk about S-holes and S-houses. Well, they're making an S-show out of this whole process, and Republicans are orchestrating a mess, and I think the public sees that, the media is reporting that, and I think it really puts Democrats in a position to be able to hold tight and hold strong and be able to make sure that a real travesty is not done, and that would be if DACA is not extended, and if you're asking young men and women who hold jobs, who have families, who pay bills, who pay taxes, if you're asking them to leave the only country they've ever known.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. But Matt, when you say the media is telling the American people the truth, that Trump and Cotton and Perdue are lying, and Senators Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham are telling the truth about what was said in that White House meeting by Donald Trump, you're admitting the fact that 30 to 35% of Americans live inside the Fox News bubble. They're not hearing that. They're hearing something different. So, I mean, this is the real problem in this country, isn't it? There's no consensus about what is true and what is real. And you've got 30 to 35% of the country immune to facts and evidence.
I think that is a problem. I think it's a shame, but I don't think it's something that you can allow to paralyze the process. About a third of the public out there wants to and intends to believe whatever Donald Trump says. I'm not sure that extends to the Republicans in Congress and the congressional leadership, to tell you the truth. I think that they're a little bit more fragile and then they're more vulnerable. But at the end of the day, the vast majority of the public understands that the process that's so profoundly broken in Washington is broken because of the failed leadership of Republicans in the Senate, Republicans in the House, and Donald Trump in the White House, who I think it's become pretty apparent is just incapable of serving responsibly as president. He's not fit to serve, and so it's not going to get better.
But when you talk about DACA, the polling is really clear on the Dreamers, that there's pretty universal, I think it's up to 70% support for the Dreamers. And Trump himself keeps talking about how he wants to protect the Dreamers and wants to act with love, and he mentioned that a couple of times. But DACA is a deferred action for childhood arrivals. So if that's the issue, where's the polling on all those kids that came from Honduras and El Salvador that are fleeing that kind of violence? Is it all wrapped up into the Dreamer, the 800,000, or are these separate issues? I'm not entirely clear on this myself.
Well, they're substantively separate issues, but I think politically they're almost the same. I just even reviewed a poll in a Republican-held state legislative district in Texas regarding Dreamers and the and treating people who are fleeing either oppression or natural disasters. And again, this is in a Republican-held district that at votes statewide for Republicans, and it was 2-1 in support of fair treatment and not deporting Dreamers and others. And so I don't know how long that atmosphere stays out there, but the message is breaking through, and I think that this is a loser issue for the Republicans. And I think that if they can get their head outside of their own primaries for just a few minutes, they'll see that it's politically very treacherous for them.
But Claire McCaskill, the Democratic senator up for re-election in Missouri, she doesn't feel that way, does she? She's making it clear that she doesn't think it's wise for the Democrats to go to the mat of an immigration issue that's not obviously popular in states that voted for Trump, where you have Democratic senators or House members. So what do you say to Claire McCaskill?
Well, what I would say to her is that I think that she's probably got a little bit more solid ground to operate on than she may think. And at the same time, I understand her really pushing for a responsible process. And that's what's really frustrating, I think, to a lot of responsible members of the Senate, most of the Democrats, some of the Republicans, and that is that this process is broken down. It shouldn't be about one issue. There shouldn't be 800,000 Dreamers held hostage to a political process. And so I think she's as much expressing her frustration with that and voters' frustration with that as she is the merits of the particular issue.
Well, my sense is, Matt, that it may not come to a government shutdown, that they will sort of come up with a kind of continuing resolution. What's your sense? It'll just be kicked down the road, right?
I think that's where the Republicans are trying to go right now. They're basically hitting the panic button here, and they're going to look for a short-term extension. And my guess is they'll get that. But sooner or later, and they've got to do more, because you've got the Children's Health Insurance Program that's hanging out there unfunded that needs additional funds, not just an extension of the same amount, and other things that are going to start to affect every single state, whether it's a red state or a blue state, and you're going to really start to damage the fabric of the services provided to citizens. And so I think the Republicans have created a mess here that really calls for some responsible behavior. And if they don't find their way to acting responsibly, I think there's a horrible political price for them to pay. Now, unfortunately, in paying that political price, I think there's some damage to the country as well. And I think the public really, again, is understanding more clearly than ever who's to blame.
Well, then let's go through the scenario of basically the Democrats taking the gloves off. It's just basically, as I mentioned, if I was Dick Durbin and his colleagues, I'd be saying to the White House and to the Republicans in the Senate, what's the point of talking to you guys? You know, you're covering up, you're lying, and how can you negotiate with liars? And beyond that, you've got the Democratic left, you've got people running on the left like Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker, clearly running for president, and Kirsten Gillibrand as well. Our senator here in California, Dianne Feinstein, is being challenged on the left. She's moving to the left as well. It would seem to me that the Democratic base is pretty I was going to use a word I can't use on the radio, but they're pretty ticked off. And if I were representing the Democrats, I'd hug the left, not trying to be too accommodating to the Republicans, because frankly, everybody I know, admittedly, I live on the west side of Los Angeles, which which is a liberal bubble, but everybody I know just hates this guy, hates what he's doing, and they're just furious, and they're frustrated, and they want this agony to end. I mean, clearly the American people have made a massive mistake and elected the wrong guy, and we have a constitution that basically puts this guy until 2020, and it's going to be hard to get rid of him.
Well, I agree with you, but for different reasons, Ian. I mean, I don't live in a liberal bubble. In fact, I live in what would be called a Republican bubble in Texas. And I think that I see, even among people who have been defaulting to Republicans for years, an absolute frustration with the broken process that has followed Trump into office. And it goes beyond a disgust and a dissatisfaction with Donald Trump to a real discontent and a real frustration with Republican leaders who are supposed to be able to make the process work. They were supposed to be the ones that were going to provide some substance and some structure so that Trump's presidency wasn't a disaster. Voters took a flyer. We both agree that it was a terrible decision by voters, but they took a flyer on Donald Trump that we're going to shake up the system and we're going to bring in somebody like him. But they were also counting on the regular process of congressional leadership in order to stand in and be responsible, and we're not seeing that. The failure we see now is only partially Donald Trump. It is, in my view, mostly Republican leadership in Congress being unable to manage their own party and their own bodies in the House and the Senate.
So just in practical terms, how do you go ahead in terms of a strategy for the Democrats to make sure that the American people know that this is entirely laid at the feet of the Republicans, both because they have this appalling president and this craven Republican House and Senate covering up for this embarrassment, and basically make sure that they're the ones that end up holding the can on this in this case?
I think you can't be too simple about it. I think they need to say, and I don't think this has been said enough by the Democratic leadership itself, remind voters and take their opportunities in front of cameras and in front of microphones to remind voters that Republicans don't need a single Democratic vote. They have the votes. They can move this if they wanted to. That they're hollering and they're complaining about Democrats now because their own Republican Party is in disarray. And I think it's very important to just say that flatly, say it cleanly. And I think then you've got voters who, whether they're partisan or not, they expect the process to work. And I think to a greater degree than we've seen in a long time, you've got people who have been defaulting to Republicans to take another look at Democrats. And even if they don't agree with Democrats on every single issue, they see voting for Democrats this time as a way to send a signal to failed Republicans and to also balance the power and realize that one-party Republican control turned out to be a failure, and we'll be much better off if we have Democrats really holding some power in Washington.
So would that mean that the Democrats can't walk out of the chamber? I don't know that that works, but could they just literally sit there and not participate? In other words, when you're saying the Republicans have the votes and they're not capable of delivering, and that's why they want Democratic votes, is there a way to go on strike if you're a Democrat and just hang these guys out to dry?
Well, I believe it's what I would call an active strike. I wouldn't boycott the process. I wouldn't walk away from it. I would participate in it by pointing to their failures and making the substantive arguments through debate. But I wouldn't give them a single vote that they didn't earn by changing their policies.
Mm-hmm. And we know, though, that Trump's not going to give an inch on DACA because his base will revolt and they won't show up to vote. So that's we know where the line in the sand is with him. Is there any movement on the Republican side that could abandon Trump? Because I imagine they're all basically afraid of their base and the right wing of the party and the Fox drumbeat, which is going to make them vulnerable in primaries.
Ian, I actually don't think Trump's where you're suggesting. I think he'll sign anything they put in front of him.
Uh-huh.
I think he will sign it and declare victory, and he'll celebrate himself
right.
as the hero of dreamers.
Right.
I mean, this is a guy who can pivot without any substance at all. He doesn't think in substantive terms. He only thinks in terms of message, and he only thinks in terms of credit for himself. I think that there is every reason to put enormous pressure on the Republicans and make them break, make them have to include the extension of DACA and taking care of the Dreamers and the others. And I think if that's on the president's desk, he'll sign it. I think he'd sign a receipt from CVS if that's what they put on his desk.
Well, indeed, I think you're on the right track, Matt, because I was struck by that recent op-ed in the New York Times by Christopher Buckley, basically making the point that Trump is not, even though often people on the left call him a fascist, he may have authoritarian tendencies, but he doesn't have any fascist ideology. He has no ideology except himself. And the point that Chris Buckley was using by going back to Suetonius's The Caesars was that this guy is more like a Roman emperor than anything in the political lexicon that we're used to, particularly here in the United States.
Yeah, he's a plutocrat and a profiteer who got himself in the White House, and it's very, very dangerous. But I believe that a responsible Congress could avoid it being a disaster, but we don't have that right now, and a Congress entirely controlled by Republicans just may not be able to be the responsive Congress that we need.
Well, Matt Engel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining further the showdown over DACA versus the wall and who gets blamed for shutting down the government.
Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred, more often just those with hate for us. Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. And you can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a concept.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Shapiro, a professor and former chair of the Department of Political Science at Columbia University, who until recently served as acting director of Columbia's Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy. A fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, his books include The Rational Public, 50 Years of Trends in Americans' Policy Preferences, and Politicians Don't Pander, The Political Manipulation and Loss of Democratic Responsiveness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Shapiro.
Thank you.
And in terms of politicians don't pander, at the moment it's pretty clear that politicians lie. The Washington Post has documented over 2,000 lies from President Trump since he's been in office, and I think it's pretty clear that Senators Cotton and Perdue are lying in contradicting Senator Dick Durbin in terms of his account of what happened in the White House, where Donald Trump made obscene and hurtful remarks. So at this point, it's the battle, isn't it? Between, I mean, if I were a Democratic senator I'd want to support Dick Durbin and basically say to both the White House and my Republican colleagues, what's the point in negotiating with you guys? You lie. You know, what's the point in negotiating with liars?
I would generally agree with that kind of analysis. But what's at stake here in terms of negotiations is, on the budget deal, is the status of the DACA issue, what to do with these young immigrants to the United States, and the question is, in this case, is it worth negotiating to try to get some kind of deal on that and coming up with some kind of compromise? Keeping in mind, there was on the table, in the wake of that meeting, a bipartisan compromise on immigration to deal with the budget, put forth by a very reputable group of Democrats and Republicans, and Trump turned it down, and it would seem to make sense for them to go at it one more time, especially given the deadline and the importance of the matters here.
Well, but that was an ambush. Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham showed up for that meeting, and they're the ones that put together the very compromise bill that you're talking about, and they walk into a room full of anti-immigrant hardliners.
Yeah, I agree with that, but what's at stake here for, well, there's stakes here for both the Democrats and the Republicans. But for the Democrats, they have good reason to push further on this in the hopes of getting the compromise, because this DACA issue is really a very important one to the Democratic Party base. And if they can get this with kind of minimal acceptable compromises on border security and anything else in the budget, it's it's worth it for them, because they're pushing forward now to the 2018 midterm election, and then to the general election, and they want to show that they can accomplish things in order to get their base out to vote for them, and to show that they can confront Trump and the Republicans on these issues.
But their base won't be happy if they give in on the wall, and as far as I can tell, Donald Trump is not going to budge.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think they have to push on that. That is the big question at this point, is will they allow the government to shut down over this budget bill, and it's certainly worth the Democrats to make a concerted effort to push on this. And with regard to the wall and immigration border security, the Republicans have incentives to come up to deal here as well, because the big question is who will be to blame for the government shutdown. And it's an open question. It's a game of what we call chicken here, in terms of two cars heading toward each other, and who's gonna turn and give in first. But both sides have a reason to want to compromise, and there are risks to both sides in terms of bearing the blame for this. On the one hand, Trump is through his lies and his racial accusations, has put himself and the Republicans in a very weak position, where the Democrats may see themselves holding the high ground, and they can stick to their guns and push to get a DACA compromise worked out, and also to get a border security compromise worked out, such that Trump can't claim he's gotten the big wall that he wants. On the other hand, to be blamed for a government shutdown, in terms of the consequences of that, in terms of government offices shutting down, in terms of welfare agencies and others being closed to assisting people who the Democrats want to protect, that really raises a lot of risk for them as well.
Well, our previous guest, Democratic strategist Matt Engel, was saying that in effect the Democrats could isolate the Republicans by essentially saying it would be a kind of passive strike, not an active strike. But they would make the argument, essentially, that you guys have got all the votes. You don't need us. So go ahead and vote. And that would expose the Republican Party's dysfunction.
Well, in terms of votes, if we're talking about legislation here, the question is, what kind of legislation are we talking about here? Is it legislation that could simply be done through some kind of reconciliation that doesn't require any Democratic senators to vote? And that's the key question here. But with regard to issues of the border wall and so forth, I believe they need 60 votes for that.
Sure.
In order.
Well, the feeling is that they'll kick the can down and have some kind of continuing resolution.
I'm not so sure about that. I think what would prevent that would be the Democrats basically holding the line here and not going along with it. That's, I mean, the big question is will they do that? And if you asked me a couple of months ago, I would say they would just kick it down the road. I think you asked me at this point, given Trump's lying and given the racial incidents that occurred recently, the Democrats may take a stand here.
Well, I'm pretty sure their base wants them to, don't you?
Yeah, well, there's a big part of their base that wants them to, and it's a question of whether they take the stand here or figure out how they're going to do it later on.
So what does that do for Claire McCaskill and vulnerable Democrats in red states and West Virginia and Indiana? The idea that the Democrats would shut down the government and perhaps they won't get blamed.
At this point, I think time is still on the Democrat side here. That is, they can hold the line now. If the government shut down for a long extended period, that would obviously have serious consequences. But a shutdown of a week or two, I don't think the electoral consequences there are significant.
But will the Republicans get blamed? They have been before. There's no question about it, and obviously they know about that. But that's a hard
one to predict. I think the Democrats could make a strong enough push, such that the blame would reside more with the Republicans than the Democrats, given recent developments. Both in the lying and both in the very strong racial overtones of the Republican administration, especially in the wake of Martin Luther King Day.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Shapiro, who's a professor and former chair of the Department of Political Science at Columbia University, who until recently served as acting director of Columbia's Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His books include The Rational Public, 50 Years of Trends in Americans' Policy Preferences, and Politicians Don't Pander, Political Manipulation and the Loss of Democratic Responsiveness. So the Democrats look as though they're going to do well with and possibly pick up the House. And I think that to some extent explains why so many senior Republicans and particularly subcommittee chairmen are resigning or giving up. And of course, Daryl Issa out here in California is the latest of them. So what's your sense then of that is really what's at stake here, isn't it? You don't want to blow your opportunity if the Democrats are, if it's looking good for the Democrats, you don't want to blow that opportunity. On the other hand, the Republicans do have this inherent problem, do they not, that they've got an incredibly unpopular leader who's getting more unpopular by the day, yet for reasons that I'm not entirely clear on, they're clinging to Trump, perhaps because they're afraid of the base.
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, this looks like a typical textbook type midterm election where the incumbent party is in a weak position. They have politicians who are basically dropping out of the race, and the Democrats will be mounting strong challenges because a lot of candidates want to run because this is a good year for a Democrat to run. The irony here, of course, is that Trump's popularity rating is low, and the Republicans are on the defensive in the context of a lot of significant major policy making successes on the part of the Republicans: the tax bill, deregulation, judicial appointments, and a booming economy and a booming stock market. This situation is really puzzling, and it shows how Donald Trump especially, but the Republicans as well, have completely mishandled a major political opportunity.
So how though do you penetrate the bubble, the 30-35% bubble that Fox News has basically created for the Trump base? And Trump, as I mentioned earlier, he basically can't give up on his wall, because I think that will alienate his base and they won't be enthused about showing up in November. What's your sense of how you can penetrate that bubble, which appears to be immune to facts and evidence?
Well, the big question is will at some point Trump cross the line and it affect his base enough to have significant electoral consequences for both him and the Republicans? And remember, you have the base out there that seems to support him come hell or high water, so to speak, and then there's a large chunk of Republicans who will stick with him and the Republicans just simply by virtue of wanting to vote against the Democrats. That is, as bad as their you know, their candidates are and their leaders are, the Democrats are worse. In terms of how to penetrate the bubble, well, we saw that in the case of Roy Moore, where basically Republican voters in Alabama decided to vote for a third party candidate, thereby wasting their vote, and that, in tandem with good voter turnout on the part of the Democrats, were able to defeat Roy Moore. What was different about Roy Moore? He basically engaged in sexual harassment, borderline assault behavior. He can be compared to Trump on that. But the one big difference with Roy Moore is what he did involved young women, girls. And so he obviously crossed the line there in some way. Well, has Trump done anything yet to cross the line? It doesn't look like it. With regard to the Russia investigation, I, for one, don't think the obstruction issue is the kind of issue that will bring him down, in the sense that that issue will not be an issue that crosses the line and lead the Republicans in the House to want to impeach him. However, the investigations of his business activity, that is, Steve Bannon may have hit the nail on the head in his interview with Michael Wolff when he talked about money laundering. And there, that could raise things to the point of if you think of money laundering involving organized crime in Russia and elsewhere, that may well be a tipping point, if it could be proven.
And of course, Steve Bannon testified before the House Intelligence Committee today, and he's due to go before Special Counsel Mueller's grand jury, I think, in the next couple of days, is he not?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But the thing is, Steve Bannon can provide the direct evidence that Mueller's committee needs. It's Mueller's investigative work involving Trump's finances that will tell the story in the end. And I think this is somehow linked to Trump's desire not to reveal his tax returns. I think there may be information in there that could be damaging to him in this context.
Well, I think you can make a case, frankly, that money laundering from kleptocrats and third world dictators and assorted despots is, in fact, the Trump business model. He got blackballed by Wall Street after taking down, a whole bunch of banks in 5 bankruptcies. And as Don Jr. said, we turn to the Russians, and that's where the money is.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, those general kinds of statements, you know, just may not have the kind of impact that systematic evidence would reveal. And once it's revealed, it could be hammered further through press reports and interrogations in the press of members of the Trump administration.
But then you get back to the fact, and when you were saying that maybe he'll do something outrageous that could pry loose some of his base voters. Recently, we've had the revelation that his lawyer paid off a porn star, $130,000. Then we had the S-hole remarks in the Oval Office that's upset all of Africa, Haiti and El Salvador and around the world. People are totally appalled. Hasn't moved the needle on his base one iota. So the question would be, what will it take? And by the way, much of his base are these good Christians. How good Christians can put up with that kind of behavior? They apparently access Hollywood tapes where he boasted about grabbing women by the genitals. That didn't move the needle with them. They still voted for him. So I, for the life of me, I don't know what it would take. I really don't.
Well, Trump himself said he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and it would have no effect. And that kind of comparison has proven to be true thus far.
Well, but you're not answering the question. Not that I think that's an easy answer.
Well, no, but in terms of what kinds of things can make a difference, I think his racist remarks, if they continue, can slowly have an increasing impact. I think having a porn star being bought off. As occurred in that one case, is not something that's going to be surprising and particularly upsetting to Trump's base.
So is there a strategy then that the Democrats could employ to, I mean, I think reasonable Republicans, more traditional Chamber of Commerce types, are increasingly uncomfortable. And I imagine the dilemma for the Democrats is that do you try and win over disaffected Republicans and move to the center, or do you move to the left, which is where the Democratic base is.
Really. Well, I think if the Democratic strategists put their heads together and look at the numbers, there are two elections at stake. There's 2018 and 2020. In 2018, they need to see to what extent a strategy focusing on their base will be enough to overcome their geographical disadvantages in terms of districting and redistricting, and how many seats in the House they can take and what they can do in the Senate. With regard to the next presidential election, and if you do the arithmetic, basically we're talking about 80,000 votes or thereabouts in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And they don't have to peel off many, if any, Republican voters. What needs to happen is for the Democrats to increase voter turnout among their base, and for just a small enough number of disaffected Republicans and independents who voted for Trump in the last election, either not to vote or to vote for the Democrats. And I think the strategy of focusing on the base is one that could very well work, given the arithmetic.
Well, here in California, they could pick up, I think, 11 of the 14 Republican congressmen voted for this tax bill that literally is petty and punitive. It's really punishing a successful blue state, and all these red state Republicans, you know, are really sticking the knife in and raising the taxes on Californians and people in New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts and other blue states. So there's a kind of pettiness to it, and I just wonder if there's a good argument that can be launched against these people, because you could pick up, you know, I don't know whether they get all 14, but they could pick up 11. That's what they need, 40, so that's a good way on the path to flipping the House, right?
Yeah, that's significant, and that's where the congressional electoral arithmetic could wind up working in the Democrats' favor, even though they at a disadvantage given the way given where people live and how the districts are drawn. And I think this is an open empirical question, and the Democrats won't know until they try that strategy and see if it works in the election. And if it works, great. If it doesn't work, they'll have to regroup and figure out how to actually win over Republican supporters.
And then we get stuck with Trump till 2020, right?
Well, that's 2018. Well, yes,
I understand.
Yes, we do get stuck with Trump for 2020, and if the Trump administration continues behaving the way it has been, even in the face of a strong economy and financial markets, they could lose the election, albeit in a close one.
Well, Robert Shapiro, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Shapiro, who's a professor and former chair of the Department of Political Science at Columbia University, who until recently served as acting director of Columbia's Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His books include The Rational Public, 50 Years of Trends in Americans' Policy Preferences, and Politicians Don't Pander, Political Manipulation and the Loss of Democratic Responsiveness. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the hypocrisy of Trump proclaiming today, January the 16th, as Religious Freedom Day. You can't hide. Yeah. Watch it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He has worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action. His books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Clarkson.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me back.
And today, President Trump proclaimed today, January the 16th, Religious Freedom Day. So I don't quite know how to react to that. I don't feel... I mean, this is the most religious country in the world, the most tolerant country in the world. There's no oppression of religion in this country. So why do we need Religious Freedom Day?
Well, partly because Congress requires it. And back in 1991, Congress authorized Religious Freedom Day, and basically the only thing that they required was that there be a presidential proclamation. So that's why that exists. But for Congress, it was kind of a belated discovery. And that is that back in 1786, the Virginia legislature passed the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which had been originally authored by Thomas Jefferson, and it was shepherded through the legislature by none other than James Madison, who a few months later went on to be the principal author of the Constitution, and then later the First Amendment. So the Virginia Statute is credited by historians as really being the taproot of the framers of the Constitution's approach to religion and government. So it's truly something to be celebrated and commemorated and not forgotten in that way. Unfortunately, President Trump has a little different approach.
And which is?
Which is that he has aligned himself with the Christian right and the contemporary efforts to redefine religious freedom in a way that would slant public policy towards their agenda, which is a kind of... exercise in political religious supremacy. So if you happen to disagree with the Christian right about the availability of contraception or the right to access abortion, or if you think that marriage equality is a good thing, you may face various forms of discrimination being promoted by the Trump administration.
So the idea of religious freedom, though, from what I'm getting from you, Frederick Clarkson, is that this basically is a religious right concept based upon the absurdity that the religious right has, this sense of martyrdom and oppression that somehow they're being impinged upon when, you know, mega church pastors are able to shake down poor people for millions of dollars on television right before our eyes. And now, of course, Trump is going to allow them, these mega churches, to participate in politics and remove the restriction in tax exemption that means you're supposed to educate and not advocate under the 501c3 tax-exempt vehicle that all the churches use. So now, again, they're getting everything. So where do they get this idea about freedom? I mean, why do you need to proclaim freedom when it's unnecessary? Because there's no oppression. There's no religious oppression in this country, except perhaps if you're a Muslim, where you get discriminated against under this ridiculous paranoid canard that Sharia law is about to be imposed on us all.
Well, we're certainly imperfect when it comes to religious tolerance and freedom, and but, you know, it's one of the best features of our culture. You know, it's a great tradition and a great effort to promote tolerance and equality and freedom in the way that as a society we've struggled to do. That's absolutely true. On the question of tax exemption and electioneering, so far the Trump administration has not gotten that through Congress. There's been no change in the law. I think that there probably is greater latitude in how it's enforced, but that's a different question. But as far as the issue of religious freedom goes, you know, it's something that is so integral to our history, our Constitution, and our law that it really is something that belongs to the rest of us and something that we've kind of taken for granted. You don't get to have free speech. You don't get to have a free press. You don't get to have political advocacy and different strong differences of opinion from the government unless you have the right to believe differently from the rich and the powerful, from powerful government institutions and powerful religious institutions. And that's the revolutionary idea that Jefferson and Madison really gave us. So the tragedy of our moment is that there are theocratic forces, aligned with the Trump administration that didn't like that when it was, they didn't like the Constitution when it was written, and they did their best to oppose it, be over the issue of religious freedom. And they want to claw that back, and they're doing their best through public policy to do that now. And it's really important that we all figure out a way to do religious freedom advocacy 21st century style.
So let's go back to the founding fathers, and you talked about the Virginia Declaration, and there was no question about what the attitudes of the founding fathers were. And remember that they were writing this Constitution not so long after the first settlers in America had proven themselves to be religious zealots, particularly in Massachusetts with witch burning, etc. So wasn't that a big part of it? I mean, apart from the fact that the guy that was the kind of intellectual spark of the American Revolution, Thomas Paine, was an atheist, although he sort of died penniless and alone because eventually his atheism became a little embarrassing for the rest of the founding fathers. But in general, my understanding is of history is that Jefferson and company really had experienced, this new country had experienced the worst forms of religious intolerance. And they just wanted to make sure that this country would never become a theocracy.
Well, that's exactly right. And these were educated men of the Enlightenment era. And they knew that what had happened in Europe for 1,000 years, they were aware of the Inquisition, in Spain. And they were aware of the similar kind of witch hunts in England. And what they were aware that the North American expression of that kind of witch hunting and inquisitional spirit inhabited the early colonies. Among the formative experiences of young James Madison, young Thomas Jefferson, were watching the beating and the jailing of Baptist preachers on the streets of Virginia, who were jailed solely for the fact that they were expressing their view of Christianity, which was against the law in Virginia, where the established Anglican Church, the religious arm of the British Empire, held sway. So, yeah, the idea of religious equality, that your religious identity would have no bearing, no advantage or disadvantage in your status of a citizen, was a part of the revolutionary idea of the time. And they knew they were standing in the bright light of history and doing something that they really hoped they could set the stage for something that would stand the test of time.
So what on this day are we supposed to do? People who are genuinely religious, and frankly, I for the life of me cannot understand these so-called Christians on the religious right in this country. Their hypocrisy is so rank at this moment, clinging to this dreadful misogynist, hater, racist in the White House who lies and lies. The Washington Post have done a study that over 2,000 lies since he's been in office. And now he's got Senator Cotton and Senator Perdue lying for him, covering up what he really said in the Oval Office in his insulting Africa, the entire continent, along with El Salvador and Haiti. And we know that the religious right went along with this guy in spite of the Access Hollywood tape where he boasted about grabbing women by the genitals. But now, whatever happened in terms of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not bear false witness. I mean, why are they sticking with this guy?
Well, power is seductive, There are theological justifications that were offered during the campaign and people will stick to now. The idea that even ungodly men can carry out God's will and God's agenda. And they pointed to King David in the Old Testament And they also appointed to King Cyrus of Babylon, who assisted the Jews. But that aside, they are willing to set aside morality and doctrine in order to advance their agenda, particularly as it serves their personal interests. The evangelical historian John Fea calls them court evangelicals because they're attracted to the power and they suck up to it, and it's a remarkable thing to see. But there are tremendous divisions going on, upset in a lot of the evangelical world over these very things, and it's I think a period of tremendous turmoil in the evangelical community.
So the fact that Trump had his lawyer pay off a porn star $130,000, you think that might be making a little bit of an inroad into the religious rights idea that their president is not entirely living up to biblical values and family values?
Well, one would like to think so, but you know, it's just the same thing we saw with Roy Moore, who was a pedophile and a stalker of, you know, teenage girls in the local mall. People stand by the guy who they think can deliver for them, despite hypocrisies and flaws. Hypocrisy has never really worked as an issue, and the more you attack their leaders, Trump and Roy Moore, on these things, the more likely it is that they're going to hold true to them, because they're really invested in these guys. And, you know, let's face it, Donald Trump is delivering for them in ways that his predecessors never have. So in terms of policy, in terms of administration positions, they're getting more than they ever could have dreamed.
And they got Gorsuch too, right?
That's right. That's, you know, look at the cabinet. You know, Betsy DeVos at Education, Mike Pompeo at the CIA, Ben Carson at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and the list goes on. There is an attorney for the Alliance Defending Freedom, one of the leading Christian right legal advocacy networks, who just got the top job in the public policy, or rather the public affairs, the PR office of the Department of Justice. This is what an important piece of what the Trump administration is about.
Well, religious freedom is a double-edged concept. It's one man's freedom is another person's oppression. If you're gay and if you're a single woman or wanting to have birth control, or a woman who's been raped and wants to have an abortion, I don't know.
It's That's exactly right. Let me clarify one thing, and that is that I think the most helpful thing for everybody to get their minds around, and that is the idea of religious freedom is not the same thing as religion, and it's not the same thing as non-religion. You know, it's a fundamental right to believe differently than anybody else and to change your mind if you want to.
Right.
And that is protected by, ideally, by a neutral government who's out to protect the rights of all.
Right.
So
we should be celebrating religious diversity, not this bogus religious freedom. I thank you for joining us, Frederick Clarkson. I'm sorry we ran out of time, but I appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He co-founded the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action, and his books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.